Hello, and thanks for listening to Eurofocus, a view from Washington, the CSIS Europe Program's new podcast series. The Europe Program will be producing monthly audio podcasts on topical and timely issues in European affairs and transatlantic relations to supplement ongoing and upcoming Europe Program activities. Today we are joined by Heather Conley, Director and Senior Fellow at the Europe Program at CSIS, to discuss the implementation of the recently passed Lisbon Treaty and what it means for Europe. Heather, thanks for joining us. What has been the process leading up to the Lisbon Treaty up to today?
It has been quite a journey for the European Union as they strive to create a great deal of reform to the institution of the European Union. This journey actually began 8 long years ago, December of 2001, where European leaders gathered to create, in effect, an institution that was more efficient, more effective, and was brought, quote, closer to the people, unquote. This took 8 years, and the journey had many twists and turns. European leaders crafted an EU constitution, which in May of 2005 was rejected by French voters. A month later, it was rejected by Dutch voters. And after these two important rejections, European Union leaders gathered a moment of reflection. They basically put the constitutional process on hold. They revised, and in December 2007, they created and crafted what is now known as the Lisbon Treaty. It put into consideration the reasons why voters had rejected the earlier constitution, and then the Lisbon Treaty began to make its way through the ratification process, only to be stopped in June of 2008 by another referendum, this time a referendum before Irish voters who rejected the Lisbon Treaty in June of 2008. But after some opt-out clauses for the for Ireland, some special considerations, the Irish voters this October voted again on the Lisbon Treaty and passed it. And last month, we had the Czech president provide the final signature that ratified the Lisbon Treaty, and now the instrument goes into effect today.
So what does this actually mean for Europe then?
The significance of the Lisbon Treaty actually is found in three specific areas. The first area is the strengthening of the role of the European Parliament. It's important to note that the European Parliament is the only EU institution that is directly elected by European Union citizens. Again, this gets to the heart of what the Lisbon Treaty was trying to do, again, bringing the European Union closer to the people. Secondly, the Lisbon Treaty is an effort to simplify the voting rules. Right now, any time the European Union votes on an important issue, it must be a unanimous decision by all 27 members. And with Lisbon Treaty, it allows for what's known as qualified majority voting. That means a majority may say yes. It does not require all in support of a particular decision. And that will be important to quicken the speed by which the European Union makes decisions. And finally, two new actors are brought to the table. First, the Lisbon Treaty establishes a permanent president of the European Council. This president is appointed for 2.5 years. It can be renewed. And in essence, this serves as the one unifying voice of all the 27 member states. This will certainly be a role that will evolve and develop as time goes on, but it's an important step in again, unifying the voice of the European Union. And secondly, and perhaps most importantly to the impact of transatlantic relations, is the creation of a high representative for foreign policy. This individual, in essence, is a European Union Secretary of State. It's a foreign minister that will have a specific European Union diplomatic service to support the work of the high representative, and it marries both the policy and resources. This is very important because prior to the Lisbon Treaty, the policy was separate from the budget allocations and resources, and the Lisbon Treaty brings those two together. Again, this is all to provide a more unified and consistent policy voice on important global foreign policy issues.
Can you expand on the role of these new posts, the personalities filling them, and what actually will happen with the new EU institutional makeup?
Well, if it took 8 years to get to this point where the Lisbon Treaty is in force, it will likely take another 8 years for these new roles and responsibilities to be fleshed out and for some pretty dramatic reorganization to occur. The 2 weeks ago, the European Union elected its new council president. It was the former Belgian Prime Minister, Herman Van Rompuy, who had only served approximately 11 months as the Belgian Prime Minister. He's fairly unknown to the international foreign policy circles. He's not a well-known figure to Washington, certainly. He was voted as a quiet, behind-the-scenes consensus builder, and I believe he will do a great deal of, internal reorganization, providing that important consensus among the 27 member states. The second person that was elected was the new High Representative for Foreign Policy, and that is Baroness Catherine Ashton from the UK. Baroness Ashton previously served as the European Union's Trade Commissioner. She, too, is not well known in foreign policy circles, not known well on the international stage. Obviously, for trade negotiators, she's known well, but fairly unknown here in Washington. Her job, I think, is probably the most challenging, because not only will she have to introduce herself on the international stage, she will also have an enormous amount of internal work to do and reorganizing, in fact, organizing a new European External Action Service. This is the diplomatic corps that will serve her. And and she will also serve as both High Representative and Vice President of the European Commission. She's going to be dual-hatted, and that also brings responsibilities and many more meetings. But for the first time, this High Representative position will marry both policy and resources, and that will actually be a very significant contribution, certainly, to the U.S.-European agenda. Again, we have a new and improved European Parliament with new powers. They're going to be taking a look now at the common agricultural policy, the important budget. They'll be looking at legal issues, justice and home affairs issues, which we call homeland security, and they'll also be addressing immigration issues. So look for a great deal of lawmaking and regulatory making that will be coming out of the European Parliament. Now, finally, what stays the same is the European Union Commission President. Again, the Commission is the executive organ of the European Union. And this summer, the current Commissioner, José Manuel Barroso, was approved for a second five-year term. So he will be learning how to work with two new colleagues, Monsieur Van Rompuy and Baroness Ashton. And finally, the European Union presidency will continue. This is a rotating presidency where each EU member state takes a six-month rotating presidency. The Swedish presidency will finish at the end of this year, and Spain will assume this rotating presidency beginning January 1st. This rotating presidency will diminish in its importance as these new institutions and new voices come to the fore, but it will continue to have a role. So you'll see lots of internal consolidation. There will be there's a whole new set of EU commissioners that have just been approved. So you're going to see a lot of new faces, new organizations, and a lot of energy dedicated to internal consolidation.
Finally, what are the important challenges today that Europe must face, and how will Lisbon help with this?
Well, the passing of the Lisbon Treaty came none too late. The European Union is going to face some critical challenges in the coming months and years, and its first challenge must be quick recovery from the global financial crisis of last year. Europe is struggling. It's struggling on several fronts economically. Its banking system is still straining. Certainly, it has not undergone the so-called stress tests that American banks have experienced, and there's still some lingering banking effects that must be watched. Last fall, we had several economic meltdowns, quite frankly, in Europe. Hungary, Latvia, Romania, Ukraine also teetering, and how Europe responds to its members who are finding themselves faltering. We're going to see continued economic challenges in Ireland, Spain, and Greece, and again, how the European Union seeks to work with specific member states to help them through the financial crisis, I think will be quite quite telling. Europe will continue to struggle with stagnant productivity. It's going to see some soaring budget deficits. And again, this is all coming with some systemic challenges within its banking system as well as its very rigid labor markets. The second area and second challenge will be creating that consistent and unified and influential foreign policy voice around the world. And certainly the most immediate need for a strong and effective European policy is in Afghanistan, where certainly many member states have contributed forces, but also have been contributing to the training of Afghan security forces and to development aid. We will need to see a strong European response for the United States to be successful in Afghanistan. Clearly, as the situation evolves vis-a-vis Iran, it will be important to maintain a strong U.S.-European consistent message on Iran and enhanced sanctions. Certainly, climate change has been a topic of great conversation as we head towards the Copenhagen Climate Change Conference. Europe has very much been in a leadership position on climate change and seeking strong targets to reduce carbon emissions. They've been a little concerned that American leadership has not been as forthcoming as they had hoped. But again, this is an area where the European Union and the United States should stand shoulder to shoulder. And finally, what we hope that comes out of the Lisbon Treaty is, again, bringing the European Union closer to the people. With some concern, the last election for the European Parliament was held in June of this year. We saw some of the lowest voter turnout across Europe. For the European Union to remain a robust and vibrant institution, it must have the support of its 500 million citizens. And we're certainly hopeful that this process and these new institutional structures will, in effect, bring the European Union closer to the people. And we certainly believe it will bring the European Union closer to the United States as it works on these important global economic and foreign policy issues.
You can find out more about the Europe Program and our new podcast series by visiting www.csis.org/Europe.